Session number 26590, General Wilhelm Murr, Reel 10.
You were saying that you had to cross some canals to make your reconnaissance towards Osnabrück.
Yes, and of course it became then that we didn't cross really where we had meant to, so because these bridges were destroyed by our own airplanes. So we were driving along the canal, and of course you drive through what you call small town or villages and so on, and it wasn't a place to stop, you know, and these were all German. And you could see what you would say a normal life and so on. It wasn't troops, it wasn't German troops, but it was a military activity with animals and farmers and whatnot. But anyway, so you just went through, but we found a bridge and we got across and we went into our direction and heading for so on. You know, in the this part of area, you find that the roads are often built up. You have the flat, low area, which are sometimes flooded by water too, and the road goes on a sort of a upbuilt
causeway.
Yeah, whatever you call it.
Embankment.
Yeah, embankment sort of thing, and it's long straight routes and it's open arable fields around. And we were driving there in our direction, and then suddenly we saw a group of Germans, men and women, and children too, standing there with their things for what they used for arable things, you know, spikes and things like that. We had to stop. There was no way, so they were just blocking the road. Obviously not attentive to us before they saw us, but there was down in the slope below and a little out on the flat area, there was a German soldier, dead. And we saw this when we stopped up against him. And beside him there was a little boy, I would say about 10, screaming and, you know, and so on. And this fellow had obviously crept down the side slope to get to that soldier, who was a visible pistol in his hand, or in a band around his neck. And I suppose a boy wanted to get hold of that. Well, I suppose that's what's happened. And he had stepped on a mine. And so he was there, you know, completely, and yelling, of course. And this had brought some people in, I don't know. It was a close by village, and a common party from there. And they were standing sort of apprehensive to what to do. They just didn't want to do. And then, of course, when we came, it became sort of our job to do something, you know. Otherwise, I don't know what would have happened to us. But anyway, so it became Barkal and I was in front. I remember Barkal was fitting a rope around my son and leading me out. And I went down where I could see the boy had went down. And of course, he had come that far, so there was no mines in that track. And I came down and I got hold of the young fellow and dragged him back and up in the jeep. And we turned the jeep quickly as we could and drove off this crowd of the people, Germans. Barkal, very busy trying to stop bleeding, I remember. He was working sort of backwards in the jeep.
Yes.
We had the boy laid on the... And we were driving, and I suppose we didn't know really where we were driving, except getting away from this place and so on. And suddenly, as we were driving, we were forking into a road which was filled with German army. There were trucks, there were guns, there were tanks, there were God knows all sorts of things on their way up to the front. And we were coming on the opposite direction, leading into this, sort of. Too late for turning, too late for anything. And nobody seemed to care. And there were German police helping, German sort of patrolling police. And they gave us sort of, and we came the other way, on RAF jeep, round or so on. We in uniform, going the opposite way. Quite amazing. And the only thing I can see that is so very plain to my thinking now or has been all the time, is really their stone faces. They were just apathetic, I would say. They were just not registering what went on outside their own head. They were up to reinforce the front, and they knew pretty well that this was going to be a pretty tough do if they survived at all, and that was the only thing that... So they left us drive in the opposite direction. And I remember we came to a town, I think it's Hanover, and we came to... we had been driving quite a distance actually, and we came to, and there was this German columns were just a continuous stream, and we came up to a town entry. You know, these German towns have this sort of thing, you drive through. It was a guard, and I asked him, I speak a little German, about where the Lazarette was, you know, and so on, and he showed, you know, there. And we drove in through there, came into the town, found a hospital and a school arrangement. And I remember we drove in there, it was an open field, open playground for the children, I suppose. I said to Barker that you got the car, and I carried this fellow up. I can't remember whether he was still, if you'll say, bleeding and kicking. Bleeding, probably not, because Barker had fixed that, but whether he was sort of unruly on my back, I don't know. There was quite a number of steps up, and I handed him into a surgical plane. I could see that on the thing. I came into the doctor, I remember I handed him the boy, and I thought this isn't a place to talk, so he pointed at the table, and I ran out and ran down. And by that time, the Germans had discovered that this car was there and it didn't belong. So they were creeping up from some direction. And Barker shouted to me that, you better hurry now, they've seen us. So I jumped in and he drove. And we went out. We went through the same gate as we came in. We followed the same stream. We couldn't avoid getting into that as we had come in the opposite course. Nobody touched us, we were just a part. Now, mind you, colors and so on, this camouflage colors, isn't that different? And this uniform doesn't stick out that different from whatever. Germans have a lot of variety in this sort of thing. So I think they just didn't think about it.
Perhaps they thought you were from the Luftwaffe.
Yeah, whatever. And although we had this little roundel, a RAF roundel, on the thing, it wasn't that big anyway, whatever, I don't know, but nobody seemed to. And then when we came to the road that has taken us into it, we quickly went out the same way. And even that is funny, because the German police didn't sort of pursue us as deserters or anything. You should have thought that, but they didn't do that. So we were left on our own, soon after we came back to the same place as this had happened, of course. And
were the people still there, or had they?
The German was still there, and the pistol was still there.
Yes.
But the people were not there. And there was some few, I wouldn't say forest, but some few trees. Because after all, in the whole of this, what we were really afraid of wasn't so much the Germans as our own airplanes. Of course, we were convinced that we were so good that nothing could move down there, and here we were moving around all the time, so it was a little disappointing, really. But anyway, we hid under there and thinking, you know, what on earth has we become part of, you know, being a sort of Samaritan, instead of doing what we ought to do, it was going reconnaissance of the airfield. And so we were sitting there, and I remember we had a cup of coffee and were thinking, but then this business and this pistol became very temptress to both of us. And again, I was the one, he got a pole which he kicked down from one tree, and I remember, and we got something on the top of it, and I crept down again to about where this boy had been, and he was behind me and fiddled this on my neck. And I got hold of this and we swung it like a fish up on the road up there. And so he crept back again, and then, of course, you know, and he won it. So that was that.
And he got the pistol.
He got the pistol. And but then, of course, we hadn't done our job. So we drove on and came to the place where there was a chalk on the map. And had no more experience. We saw the old farmer, passed the old farmer. But this wasn't an occupied area at all. It was just sort of fairly empty. And you know, in Germany, as in France and so on, you find these wide areas with not any people on at all. Very, very little. So we came up to this and we hid the car and stuck fairly close to it as much as we could. And when we moved around and made a croquis, as we say, the map sort of thing, of how we wanted the things laid out. And when we got to further distance, the airfields are fairly big. We always moved the car with us, so you had an exit if something. Didn't see anything. And did the job and went back, and nothing happened. We arrived back on the airfield late in the evening. And the next day, the wing was ordered back to England. So we never moved to this airfield.
You didn't go to Oslo?
No, no, we never moved.
When you went out on reconnaissance to find an airfield, what would you be looking for? What are the essential characteristics?
Well, you want to see how the airfield is placed in the terrain. What about the surroundings? With are there hindrances? What would the approach be for being a good reasonable approach? Of course, flat areas aren't it, in some mountainous areas. That's a great point. And you would sort of log the road system that is available to you for support of that airport, and you would designate how the area would suit itself for where do you want to disperse the airplane, where do you want to have the main workshops thing, where you want to have the catering part, and so on. So you make what we call a croquis. I don't know what you have in. So it's a rough map.
It's a French word meaning sketch.
Yeah, a sketch. Croquis. A sketch, yes. Of that particular area. Fairly loose sketch, of course, you've got to. But that's the way it is. So that people, when you arrive there, transport people know that this is where they go and have to arrange themselves, and the squadron know what the area is allotted to them, and that sort of thing, and where you want to have the mess. So you can really put people to work quickly and without too much disorganized. But it was a funny way to stop the war, actually, I thought. It had nothing to do with neither ground combat nor a flying combat or anything like that.
Once you've identified a place as a suitable, what sort of dimensions would you have for one of your airfields?
Well, you wanted 1,500 yards, and you wanted free area on both sides, so that you let down and take off and so on. And you want preferably some fields, if you have some problems in, say, take off and lose your engine, you don't crash an airplane into unfavorable things, like, you know, so you keep directions and so on. But then, of course, you've got to keep in mind about where's the predominant wind and so on. With that, you have to take more or less from meteorology study, more than, because you aren't living there, you don't want to talk with people. it's a judgment. It's a judgment.
Presumably it would have to be well drained.
Yes, I would say you have to be able to take it in at the look, more like, and so on. And then you have to measure up certain things so you know what you're talking about.
Once you've decided that a particular place was suitable for an airfield, how long would it take the pioneers to actually prepare it so you could actually move in?
Oh, that would come as quick as you can. But I mean, in this case, they wouldn't come in before it was a secured area. Otherwise, they'll get the army onto them. And then you get the German army. I mean, we didn't see anything of this. I mean, there were the forces are concentrated in certain things, and they can move there if they know about it. But they otherwise. But if they started coming in with things, then they wouldn't be left at peace to do things at all.
But once you've decided this area is good for us, what would your pioneers do? Did they lay...
The main thing they had to do, and that is the thing that only they can do, they have to lay this prestige planking.
Ah.
Yeah, so that you get you can land. Mm. Because a normal soft surface wouldn't take the airplane, or if it took the airplane, it wouldn't take the load of many airplanes and so on. And if you get a real rainy day and so on, it would get some wet, then the airplane would tip up and so on. So we used this pressed-steel planking, the pioneers. And this was a big, heavy thing, you know. It took a lot of truck rides to bring that forward. And they had to... But they very often worked in very exposed areas. They should be as quick as possible after the army had cleared the area. In this case, of course, they would just have to wait until the army had cleared the area. But it was a funny experience, actually. So,
how did they lay the plates? Did they lay the plates by hand?
Yes, they do. They are heavy, yeah. But they hook them onto each other. They are about broad as that, three yards, I would say. Mm. But, so they can lift them, two men can lift them, and they hook them on to each other. And they peg them. Otherwise you can risk that the airplane is sort of half pushing them, and they raise it as a wave in front of you. And when that wave is getting up to a point, it becomes very dangerous. So it's got to be pegged down, and it's very useful. And then sometimes you can have that on runways only, but sometimes you do have to have it on the taxiways back into to the runways. So it's a big job, big job.
It must take an awful lot of man hours to create such an airfield.
Yeah. They were trained like mad, you know. Oh, yes.
You were saying that you'd just done this reconnaissance of the airfield near Oslo, and then the wing was ordered back to England. Why did that happen? Was this because war was running down?
Well, there was it was a day when the peace broke out in Europe, I should say.
Yes.
But it wasn't sure that it would be... No, the peace broke out in Europe the day after we came back. Mm. Because we settled up, and as the Marines say in America, settle up and go. We went heading back for Antwerp.
Yes.
The next day, and halfway, I remember that it was Armistice Day in Europe, and the but the RAF stayed on, of course, and we wanted. If you asked us, I remember my friend Mary said that, gosh, if I had my, we would have followed up through North Germany, up Denmark, and back to Norway,
yes,
naturally. But we were asked to come back to Britain to prepare ourselves for whatever happened in Norway, because Norway was exempted at that time. And there was a lot of thought or danger that the Germans would consolidate in Norway, make a sort of fortress Norway, Norwegian, and that would be a siege of a period, and we were to be used in that, which was, of course, natural. But it took us away from following the tactical air force up through Germany, and we went back to England. We went over to Northfield. We re-equipped. Got new airplanes, and went up a little further, and went across by sea to, again, the ground crew, the pilot flew across to Gardermoen. I forgot the date when we came to Gardermoen, but it was about 3 weeks later.
Were they able to fly direct to Gardermoen?
Yes. They landed at Sula. Did they land at Sula? Yes, they landed at Sula.
When you were re-equipped, were you re-equipped with the same type of aircraft?
Yes.
There were Spitfires still.
Mm. Mark 9, of course, at that time.
Yes. And what was the situation in Norway when when you arrived.
Mm-hmm.
What was the situation in Norway when you arrived? When you arrived at
Gardermoen? Well, here again, I arrived with the ground crew.
Yes.
And the ground crew went to Kristiansand, not to Gardermoen. The pilot flew into Gardermoen. The king was there to receive them, the crown prince, rather. Part of our ground crew from Kristiansand was taken up to support up there, but then, of course, then you had a British mission that had come to Oslo and settle. And I stayed down at Kivik with the ground staff. We had a British squadron with us. We in fact had two squadrons down there. One was a small element of Albatross, walruses for rescue services, but that was only three planes, seaplane, float planes. And then we had another squadron. And that squadron, that was, what's his name then? The famous man in Rhodesia, Ian.
Ian Smith.
He was there.
Was he?
He was there. Yeah.
What sort of man was he?
He was a pilot on the squadron. And he was, yes, he was there. It was a tremendous summer, weather-wise and so on. We hardly ever had such a wonderful summer, really, not only by coming home and so on, but the summer was a perfect thing. And the business of coming home and so on, of course, was quite tremendous. Then I was asked by, I was commanding the wing then, or yes, at the time, at Kevik, which included then a lot of British personnel as well, on ground crew side. This squadron, as I mentioned, was of course British. And I was asked to, by our ministry, came a letter that when you get into the demobilization site, you must talk with crews before the number gets up. A number is married, for how long have you been in, and how old are you, you know, one thing and the other. And they sort of ease their way into civilian life again. That, you know, and I wish I had done that a lot more, a lot earlier, because, gosh, did I meet a lot of interesting people there. Who were taxi driver, just wanting to get back to be taxi driver in London, you know. And one who was going back to his old employment, and I asked what it was. Oh, it was in a transport company. So he was happier having been in transport with us, you know, he had learned a lot. And I asked what sort of transport he was dealing with, and he said, was elephants in Burma. He was so wondering, they had written and said that the post was open, and he was just so anxious whether the elephant would remember him or not, you know, that sort of man, you know.
They say that elephants never forget.
No, they say so, and he was very curious on that one. And there was one who was a textile, a fabric worker, as we call him, those who has to do with parachutes and repair of fabric. And he was the son of a big owner of textiles up in Midlands. And how he had fared in he was a corporal, really, in the RAF and so on. And he was so happy, he had really learned a trade, because being son and meant to more or less go into the hierarchy of so on, he never learned a trade. And now he learned to trade, he said. He was the happiest could be. It's nice meeting people of that kind, you know. It was a good period.
Did you see anything of the Luftwaffe in Norway when you got back?
Not in action. As we got back, they were all clamped down. We had some of their airplanes, especially the small Fischler Stork, which we used to communicate with. It was a good little airplane. But otherwise we did see them. But of course there were a lot of Germans on the airfield, and they were used as labourers. And they behaved extremely. They were ordered to behave. They, you know, they take orders, these Germans. And I remember when they were asked in that period to destroy all German airplanes, which included, you know, Focke Wulfs and finest airplanes. They were, by, you know, by energy and enthusiasm, they threw them over into the riverside that went by. And, you know, I couldn't make us do that with a Spitfire, I'm sure, but they seemed to be cooperating as much as you could. Longing to get help, of course. Yeah. Longing to get home as fast as possible. But we had no problem with them at all, no problem. But no reason to be friendly, I mean, mind you, but no problems, no.
No complaints, though?
No. It was natural function, natural effect and so on.
Had you at that time got any ideas about what you were going to do, after the war was over?
No, I was a regular.
Yeah.
And I was married too at the time, married in England, a Norwegian. So there was a question of taking up my engineering. I started on engineering when the war came, but I hadn't really got at it. I'd been admitted to MIT in the States,
yes.
Massachusetts, but I didn't, because of the war, I never got there. So I was wondering to take that up. We had an offer to join in on the sort of rough flying in Canada.
Yes.
And I had a wife who would have done both with pleasure. Mm. But it was a little hard to just leave the Air Force when you are regular. And I remember I talked with Eula Morris once about that, just before the war finished. And what to do after the war. He was a regular. And I talked about these plans that you might have and so on. And he said, well, you remember, if you stay, you'll always be among young people who know something. And that's always so on. But he also said that, remember, when you get older, and you go to inspect these people and so on, if you get higher ranks and so on, always take yourself in the back hair and the hairs and think what you thought when you were at their age before you go in. And it's amazing how it will help you when you get in and talk with them. And I've always thought of that because it was a very good idea, a very good lesson, really. Otherwise, you know, senior people come and inspect and so on, that can, and so on. But if you put yourself in their point, it was a useful advice. Always remember that. But as it was, I was drawn into the headquarters in Oslo. Oh.
This was Air Force headquarters in
Oslo? Yeah.
What was your appointment there when you went to Air Force headquarters?
Well, what was it? I was actually put on personnel. That's operation in peacetime, you know, that's personnel. And it was a lot of personnel problem. Of course, you had around demobilization things and so on. Very fortunately, you can almost say in the beginning, most people who came back from the war had lost really their period of education,
yes,
in civil life. And they found that their equals in age and so on had really drifted into, you can say, jobs and so on, which were not attainable without the education. So a number had the same problem as I. Shall I start taking up engineering, or what shall I do? But fortunately for them, really, I would say the civil aviation got going at an increasing pace, the same in your country. And that swallowed a lot of these people, and this was something they could, they were able to do. And I would say that it was good for them, it gives them an employment, and surely, and it was good for civil aviation. And it wasn't only pilots, it was ground crews as well, technicians and so on. So that fitted in extremely well, made it eased the transfer to a considerable extent. Another thing is, of course, that I met later that some of them really were maybe slanted for being a doctor or a lawyer or something else, you know, and found themselves as time went on that this isn't really what they bargained for. But then when you're set in the seat for that long and so on, and you become, you do that, you know. And it's a good salary anyway, civil aviation.